Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. This is our annual year-end episode of the podcast. Over the previous 11 months, we've heard from scholars and sports writers about their new books. Now, to close the year, we devote a double-length episode to some of the big issues of 2013. This is not your typical year-end sports wrap-up program. We don't have top 10 lists or highlights of the year's biggest plays. Instead, we brought together academics and journalists to talk with each other about events that reached beyond the sports pages. We conducted these panel discussions by Skype over the last few weeks. For me, it was great fun to eavesdrop on some of the sharpest commentators around as they exchanged their insights and opinions on some of the most profound problems plaguing sport today. Later in this episode, we'll learn about the demonstrations in Brazil this past June and July, and what the political problems in that country portend for the FIFA World Cup in 2014. We'll also discuss the ways that being a fan can compromise our moral convictions. Like any year in sport, 2013 had its fill of scandal. In this episode, we ask whether we, as fans, can just shrug off the bad news, open another bag of snacks, and enjoy the games. Our first conversation looks at the most popular sport in the United States, football. You wouldn't know it by looking at the television ratings or the filled stadiums on Saturday and Sunday afternoons, but American football is in the midst of a crisis. Many, many former players experience symptoms of dementia and depression, even in their 40s and 50s. In recent years, there's been an unsettling string of suicides by former professional players. Most shocking was the death of Junior Seau, one of the top players of the 1990s, who took his own life at age 43. Autopsies conducted on Seau and other former players have shown that they suffered from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, known as CTE, a type of chronic brain damage. This past autumn, the National Football League settled a lawsuit on brain injuries brought by more than 4,000 former players and agreed to compensate affected players. The league also committed tens of millions of dollars to further research on brain damage in former players. But also this fall, an investigative book and documentary film titled League of Denial charged that the NFL had stonewalled the research into CTE and still does not give sufficient attention to the risks that players face. The discoveries surrounding CTE have raised questions as to the safety of tackle football, not only among NFL players, but all the way down through the college, high school, and youth ranks. To get a deeper view on the problems that football faces and the future of the sport, we'll hear from two people who have written a lot about the sport at the professional and college levels. Patrick Ruby is a writer with Sports on Earth and other outlets, including The Atlantic Online and ESPN. His writing has been featured in annual volumes of the best American sports writing, and he also teaches classes on sports journalism at Georgetown University. Michael Oriard is Professor Emeritus of English at Oregon State University. A former college and pro player, he has written a number of books on the history and culture of football. To start our conversation, I asked Mike to explain why football, as a sport, has had such a deeply rooted place in American culture.
Well, I think the obvious thing that people think about when they think about football is the violence. But to my mind, that's a key element of it. But it's also important that the violence be coupled with this artistic beauty or whatever you want to call the opposing side. So I think it's the tension between the two, the violence and the artistry, and the resulting, let's call it, intensity of the experience, both for the players and the viewers. You know, I think football has been this really powerful compensation for, you know, what happened as we become more civilized and organized and bureaucratized and so on. And so it's that, you know, the old cliche about You know, sports is life with the volume turned up. You know, football, the volume is just turned up louder than in any other sport. And I think that's the key to its power in our culture.
I just feel like there are so many reasons why football sort of occupies the cultural place it does right now in America. They've been explored by people like Mike. I mean, there's cultural reasons where historical type reasons where you've got, this sport came along and really sort of became popular starting with, the Reconstruction after the Civil War into the early part of the 20th century, where you had this sort of desire to almost recreate the battlefield, but in a death-producing way, ironically. Obviously, it's incredibly tied into our cultural conceptions of masculinity. All you have to do is go back and look at Theodore Roosevelt and honestly look at the progressives at the turn of the last century and generally look at why they pushed sport as a part of education, but particularly pushed football. This sort of idea that, and this is an idea that recurs time and again in American culture, and probably recurs in many cultures, but it seems very peculiar to America, hand-wringing over we're going soft, we're not tough enough, we're not macho enough. Football is always a salve to that. Just the other week, ABC News had a big piece about concussions, brain damage, CTE in football, and they talked to Georgia coach Mark Rick, and he said the same thing. I think our kids are getting soft. I don't think they're tough enough. I mean, it's, you can pick that out any year, any decade, and someone's complaining about that. I think in a lot of places tied into masculinity, football is somewhat of a coming of age thing for young boys. And it's culturally tied to that too, in terms of how the communities look at them. It's also, let's be honest, a perfect thing for television age in terms of being programming that you can throw on television. It works really well on television. It's entertaining on television. You can sell advertisements against it on television. You can break it up into segments of viewing and sell the ads around that on television. Football wouldn't be where it is if we didn't care about TV as much as we do. So there's so many reasons. I could go on, but I feel like I'm sucking up all the oxygen right now.
Michael, I will ask you, because you have written about this connection of football and notions of American masculinity and done some research on this, right?
Yeah. And everything that Patrick just said, absolutely, yeah. Masculinity is, I think, the single most important element in football, with race a kind of a distant second. It's really been powerful. And it's been more intense at certain periods than at others, and they happen to be periods where we're particularly agonizing over this softness that Patrick mentions. And when we're really prosperous, when things are going well, there is this greater need, it seems, to celebrate football as the antidote to what's going on. So I'm talking about the 20s, I'm talking about the period right after World War II, when suddenly prosperity replaced wartime and depression and so on. And then I'm thinking about our own time, where as we get more and more comfortable, football seems importantly primitive, as a kind of antidote to that. Now, how that works for the viewers, for the spectators, as well as the players, is another matter altogether. You got the real experience on the one hand, the vicarious experience on the other hand. So I think you have these periods, and the earliest one is the one that Patrick mentioned, the era right around the turn of the 20th century. But in some ways, I think this has also been continuous through the century. I mean, in a way, football is an antidote to civilization. Its primitivism has a kind of counterforce to what, for the most part, of course, we embrace. We like these comforts and so on, but they make us feel a little bit uneasy. And so in some ways, this has been around for the entire duration of football's existence, but more intense at some times than others.
I think, too, if I could jump in, conversely to that point, I actually feel that there is something about the current cultural moment we're living in the United States really connects with what football is and what football has become. And I want to unpack this because I think it connects in a couple different ways. If you look at sort of American society and politics, particularly the last 30 years, basically since the Reagan presidency, where American-style conservatism has been ascendant, it's pretty hard to argue that America has not become a more individualized society, a more cutthroat society, a more market-oriented society, a more nakedly capitalistic society, a more competitive society. We're much more of a, I've got mine, you get yours. If you're hurt, you're to blame. You deal with it. Next man up kind of culture. And that is exactly the model of professional football, at least, and probably football at almost all levels. It's a very, for lack of a better term, it's a very Darwinian kind of sport. I mean, all sport has winners and losers, but football, when you add in the level of violence, the level of injury, you add in how the players are basically discarded when they're no longer useful to the team or to the system, I think it's starting to reflect for more and more where America has been going in terms of its values as a culture and society. And I think in some ways, underneath the surface of the pomp and the circumstance and the glorification, I think those of us who are spectators in that vicarious experience that Mike was talking about, I think we also realize how precarious the places of these same football players who we worship almost as demigods, how quickly it can all end for them. And I think we see ourselves in that as much as we vicariously live through sort of their glory and their seemingly superior strength and efficacy over things. So it's complicated.
And let me just echo that. It's complicated. Yeah, virtually anything you can say about football, you can flip it over and look at the other side. I mean, it's the tension between these things. And so, you know, the individualism and the sort of Darwinian survival of the fittest that Patrick mentions is in some ways countered by the intense camaraderie and communitarian and team-oriented aspect of it as well. You know, and so there's that as a kind of counterforce to, I think, what is probably this dominant Darwinian aspect. But it's always complicated. It's never reducible to explanation. And in fact, you know, another part of football's history is that it has been repeatedly reduced to a single explanation, either positive or negative. You know, it is utterly brutal, or it makes men out of boys. You know, well, no, it's complicated.
You know, it's a great point that Mike brings up about sort of the communal aspect of football's appeal, because I think that's a huge part of it that we haven't mentioned really. And I think it works in two ways. Again, you've got, for the people who play, there is an incredible sense of bonding that generally these teammates have with each other, probably even more at the youth level, maybe at the professional level, because then it's more of a sort of portable job, like the jobs we all have in the rest of society. But, you know, there is obviously, these people are going out, they're sharing this intense and dangerous experience together. That's generally what tends to happen in that kind of situation. And so you've got that sense of, we're a team, we're a unit, we're a group, we're a tribe in a way. And I think there's a lot of sort of that longing for tribalism in society, the larger sort of spectator society's love of football. You know, you wear your team color. I mean, this is true for all sports, but I think football tends to bring this out the most, whether you're talking about an NFL team in a city or you're talking about a small town, a high school football team. People want to feel like they're part of something bigger. We are social animals. We are social creatures. We want to feel like we are part of a tribe or a family or a group. And football, I think for reasons that Mike could probably unpack better than I can, speaks to this need. And as we become, again, more of, in some ways, an atomized society, that need grows and we look for something to fill it.
Patrick, some of the work you've recently done for Sports on Earth shows that there are some cracks beginning to form in football's hold on people, particularly among the parents of young boys. So could you talk about what you've been finding out in your work recently?
Well, I mean, you know, I looked into this for a story I recently published. It was called The Choice. It's on Sports on Earth, and it was about the decision that parents are facing, which is, do I want to allow or encourage my son to play football? Given what we now know and what we are still learning about the brain damage that can result from the sport. And I want to use that term very plainly, brain damage. You know, a lot of times in the coverage that's been in the media and sort of our popular understanding, things are focused on like particular diseases like CTE or a particular thing like concussion. But what we're really talking about is a wide spectrum of brain damage. Some of it can be very bad. Some of it doesn't seem very bad at all. Some of it seems to resolve itself with proper medical care, as far as we know what that proper medical care is, which we're still learning too. And we're talking about a wide range of basically getting hit in the head while playing the sport of football. It's not just concussion. So I just want to make that part of it clear. Again, it's like Mike said, it's complicated. It's not as simple as saying concussion crisis. But because of all this, to get to your question, yes, participation numbers are dropping in youth football. They've been dropping over the last 4 or 5 years now. Whether you look at Pop Warner, where you look at high school football, where you look at other youth leagues, you look at what the Sporting Goods Manufacturers Association, the numbers they put together are. There's a pretty clear trend, although it is early, and it is not, you know, we're not talking about a 50% drop-off, at least not yet. I think the challenge for the sport, you know, not for parents, not for kids, not for schools, but we'll talk about that a little later. The challenge for the sport in terms of wanting to remain viable and profitable and culturally important is in some ways the challenge it has always faced, whereas the football has always walked the tightrope of basically, and they've been on the right side of the tightrope, of not being seen the way boxing is seen culturally. Yes, football is dangerous. Yes, it is violent. Yes, it is rough and tough. But no, it is not a blood sport the way boxing is now seen. When you become seen as a blood sport in America, you can still be popular. You can still make money. We still have boxing, and MMA makes quite a bit of money. But you can't be culturally relevant and significant in the same way. And to put it in sort of bottom line monetary terms, that means that you can't attract the kind of, you know, major corporate sponsors that want to attach themselves to you, that sort of validate your place as, you know, an acceptable part of mainstream, safe, wholesome American culture. Football's challenge in terms of their own product and their own viability is to stay on that side of the tightrope. I don't know if they're going to be able to over the next 20, 30, 40 years, but it probably won't change overnight. A lot of things like this, they happen slowly and then all at once.
Mike, do I remember, did your sons play football?
My younger son did, yeah. And I'm really grateful today that they're 29 and 33 instead of 10 and 14. And so my wife and I are not agonizing over this. But, you know, Patrick is absolutely touching on, you know, the key to whether football survives or not and in what form it does. You know, today, you know, I make this comment repeatedly, and it's not my own. And, you know, other people say this as well. You know, football is the closest thing we have to a mass culture in this country. You know, the privatization and creating niches, marketing niches and so on has been so pervasive. You know, I've been wondering, okay, is football going to be damaged at all by the kind of ratcheting up of the evidence that we have a real problem here? And, you know, the answer for this season anyway is no. You know, 19 of the top 20 TV programs I recently found, you know, between, you know, September and November, you know, were NFL games. You know, as Patrick says, you know, participation numbers are down, but they're not precipitously down. And so I'm wondering about that. And I'm thinking, okay, so parents like, you know, the ones that I live around are making these hard decisions. And, you know, the sensible decision today is at very least don't let your kid play tackle football till high school. And then it becomes an agonizing decision at that point. And, you know, which parents are opting out of football? Well, parents whose kids have options, who have alternatives on. So, yeah, if football increasingly moves towards boxing, you know, as an economic phenomenon as well as a cultural phenomenon, and it moves that way because we become increasingly aware of how dangerous it is to players' brains, not just their bodies. I ask myself, will we be willing, we collectively be willing to watch this sport and understand that what we are seeing out there are young men from disadvantaged backgrounds who are risking their brains for our entertainment? I like to think we wouldn't, we collectively wouldn't. And certainly we individually, in many cases, will not be watching it. So football will move towards more and more towards boxing as a niche sport rather than as a mass spectator sport. But as Patrick said, it's not going to happen immediately. It hasn't started happening in any sort of measurable way yet, but this is the tendency. And the thing that can prevent that from happening, I mean, the real dilemma that anybody who likes football wants to see it persist and so on, the real dilemma today is the limits on what we know. We know so much more about the dangers of football to players' brains, but we don't know the full extent of it. We don't know what percentage of players are going to get what kinds of brain damage from it. You know, we don't know which kinds of blows cause the worst damage and all that sort of thing. And that's going to be slow to figure out. And so while that is going on, parents, based on limited information, are going to be making these decisions. To me, the stupidest thing I've heard out there is that the assault on football is a liberal conspiracy, you know.
Oh boy,
and
I've heard that too.
And to me, it's an insult to conservative parents. Wait, conservative parents don't care about their kids' well-being, you know? Yeah. I mean, come on, give me a break. This isn't a political thing. I mean, this is in fact a social, economic, cultural, everything but political thing. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's interesting if you look at sort of where the debate over football has gone kind of in the last 6 months to a year, you start to see, I think, sort of elements of and reflections of the politicized debate over climate change, where
we're
no
point.
Longer really debating what we know and what we suspect and what is suggested by research and in some ways by common sense, but we are rather retreating into our sort of ideological camps and basically saying that anything that contradicts our ideology comes from a biased place and can't be trusted, and therefore is, you know, dismissed and devalued. Mm-hmm. And in some weird ways, you know, this is too complicated for this podcast, but I'll just throw it out there as a quick mention. If you have studied sort of the NFL's liability defense strategy over the years on this this topic, which is something I've studied a lot and I've talked to a lot of people, and I've compared it to what corporations do in other industries where their product causes harm, and they would prefer not to admit that nor be held financially liable for that, there's kind of a corporate playbook out there to follow that we've seen with lead paint, we've seen with tobacco, we've seen with other things. And the NFL, which we should note, by the way, is run by liability lawyers. You know, Roger Goodell is the commissioner, but their chief legal counsel is Jeff Pasch. Paul Tagliabue is the former commissioner. That was his specialty. The NFL is very tight with a law firm here in D.C. called Covington & Burling. That was one of the big tobacco's major sort of defense firms. There's a lot of connections there right below the surface that people aren't aware of. And if you look at their sort of strategy, I think that they have gone from a sort of big tobacco-like approach where they were producing junk science and they were basically selling doubt as a product to more of a energy companies and climate change approach, where they're kind of admitting there's a problem, but never in a way that can make them liable. You know, they're admitting it through some of their actions, not through their rhetoric. And meanwhile, all their rhetoric is very much, sort of, so to speak, greenwashing the issue and saying, you know, there's technological solutions. We can solve this. We're going to change some rules. We're going to introduce heads-up tackling. I mean, those things in some ways are the equivalent of clean coal. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that they will work. They sound nice, and they sort of speak to what people would like to believe, that if we just, you know, sort of find these, like, rule-based and technological solutions, everything will be fine. I can get back to just enjoying this product guilt-free. And that's kind of where they're at in their sort of public relations battle right now.
And we're innovative Americans, and so just as we can solve climate change and still have economic growth, we can solve football.
All right, yeah, we can solve climate change, but still burn coal and still drive cars everywhere. I mean, that run on gasoline. That's kind of the fantasy that we have about those sort of things. And I believe, from what I know, what I've studied, and who I've talked to, football, at least at the NFL level, is somewhat pursuing the same strategy. I do think one thing Mike brought up a little earlier, which I think is really important about this whole question that hangs over the sport, is that it is ultimately a moral question. You know, it's a question of what level of risk is acceptable for who within our society. And I think because of that, when we're talking about where the sport's going, we have to separate adults playing football and children playing football. Because with adults, we're really talking about people taking on, risk with informed consent. And we're talking about workplace standards and employer responsibilities and things that, you know, we've somewhat figured out in other aspects of society that are things that are dangerous jobs, like coal mining, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think that's the model in some ways to think about professional football, the way we think about adults boxing or adults in MMA. Mm-hmm. But with children, it's totally different. There are there's troubling questions. I think, forget the whole parents just asking, should my personal individual kid play? There's bigger social questions there that I don't think we've started to really ask yet. And to me, the two biggest ones, and I'd love to hear what Mike thinks about this, are, A, can parents, given the state of knowledge we have, really give informed consent to this activity for their children? B, given just what we know right now about football and the risks it presents to those developing brains, and given that schools, I'm talking about colleges and high schools, and junior highs, schools are in the business of nurturing young brains and protecting young brains. Morally, should they be in the business of football as well? Is that an activity for their students that they should be supporting, encouraging, and endorsing? And I don't think we've really started asking that.
Yeah, and both of those are key questions whose answers will help define football's future, you know? Can parents give informed consent? Well, yes, if they have good information that they can trust, that they can base their decisions on, even if that information is partial. But as Patrick says, and this is one of the sort of the horrifying larger context for me in all of this. You know, the idea that science is no more than ideology is sort of underlying all of these issues, you know, climate change, you know, evolution, whatever, you know, and also the brain science. Okay, so I'm really comfortable coming out of an academic world and understanding the limits on science. There is never going to be absolute truth about anything that matters in the world as I see it. But you always operate on the best information you have available. And the best information we have about what's happening to our climate, what's happening to football players' brains and so on, comes from scientists. And so you look carefully at the science and you see, you know, what it has revealed and you know, what is left to be uncovered and so on. And, you know, with climate change, you know, the evidence of a man-produced climate change is overwhelming. But then you have these little isolated cases, you know, and if somebody looking at this stuff believes that it's all just ideology, it just depends on which TV network you get your information from, you know, this is horrible. I mean, how do you move forward under those kind of circumstances? You know, the medical evidence related to brain damage in football isn't nearly so overwhelming yet. But there are things we do know. I mean, there are really important things that we do know, and particularly important about developing brains, as Patrick says. So dealing with kids and adults differently, it makes absolute sense. Somebody has to make the decision for kids, and they have to make it based on limited information. Well, if you just dismiss what you don't want to believe as ideology from the other side, you know, what kind of informed consent is that? But also, too, for the players themselves, I don't think there are too many 24, 25-year-old NFL players who really understand what it will feel like at age 45 to have severe brain damage from your years in the NFL. Plus, you could factor in the social costs or the economic costs to us as a society. I mean, there are going to be medical bills to be paid that come from that, you know, that whole pool that we spend on our medical costs and so on. So it's not just an individual choice. It really is a social choice, a societal choice.
I'm so glad that Mike brought that up, because that's another elephant in this room that is only being talked about a little bit, which is, just from a practical standpoint, who's going to pay for all of this? And I don't just mean, you know, the research into what is happening to the brains of football players, because, you know, frankly, A, there is a lot we still need to learn about the brain, and B, we're not living in a time where science funding is all that easy to get anymore. And then there's a whole other can of worms where the NFL is running around making donations and grants And given their sort of the history of NFL-funded science that we see in League of Denial, we should all be a little bit skeptical, to put it mildly, about where that money is going, what it's funding, and why, and what kind of results are going to come out of those studies. And again, that's probably a subject for a whole other podcast.
Yeah. Well,
but on top of that, there's the cost of the damage. Mm-hmm. Once the damage is done, who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for? And this is not just with concussions and brain damage. This is just with the old run-of-the-mill, and I say that ironically, physical damage that football produces. A lot of times comes, you know, it actually really affects you in life well after your playing days. Yeah. It's almost like a pre-existing condition if you get older and you played football, or at least a certain amount of football. And who's going to pay for that? I mean, right now, the NFL, again, if you look at how things are set up with them and their union and their disability plans and their retirement pensions and all this stuff, they've done a very nice job of sort of taking the health costs of their industry and externalizing them to the rest of society.
Yeah, yeah.
A typical corporate move.
And even beyond brain injuries, I know that looking at health problems, you just have the health problems of these, you know, former 300-pound linemen who just have a variety of health problems, heart problems, diabetes, and so forth. And I think of Reggie White, for instance, and who died when he was 42 of chronic health problems. And I think I agree with you, Patrick, that this is a big question. It does go beyond brain damage. But Michael, we cut you off before you're going to talk about schools.
Yeah, sorry, Mike.
Okay, so yeah, the schools are in a particularly precarious position, and it's weird that they've sort of gotten a pass so far. You know, the brain doesn't care whether it's hit by a 300-pound NFL player or a 300-pound college player. You know, the impact's the same. And so everything that's happening, you know, in a very public way to NFL players is happening to college players as well. But most of the attention has been focused on the NFL so far. You know, Patrick's point, do schools have some kind of moral obligation to reconsider whether they should sponsor this? I mean, that's a really important question. I mean, if you're involved in educating young people, then damaging their brains would presumably be the last thing you want to do. But, you know, right now there's still, you know, all of these uncertainties about the extent of the damage and so on that's allowing, you know, things to continue without too many ripples. But one of the things that we haven't mentioned that I think is going to be key for the high schools and probably for youth football, too, is liability. I mean, insurers are going to simply make it more and more impossible for school districts to afford the sport. I mean, even in places where high school football is wildly important culturally, you know, in the South, West Texas, and so on, you know, the liability is going to become an issue. I mean, the more and more lawsuits that happen, you know, is going to get insurers and school districts, you know, looking at this whole business differently. Another thing that we need to get out there, too, I mean, you know, the problem is that while all of this stuff is going on, we're facing all these uncertainties, and you can just be kind of crushed by the confusion of it all. But there is one piece one scientific breakthrough that will have a really profoundly important role here, I think, and that will be if they can discover a biomarker for identifying CTE and maybe other kinds of brain damage in living brains rather than having to wait till autopsies. I mean, just imagine if you could do some kind of, you know, relatively simple test of all current NFL players and all NFL players, you know, 5 and 10 years out, and come up with a figure, X percent, you know, have, you know, varying degrees of CTE in their brains. All of a sudden, ideology would seem to me trumped by simple brute fact. You know, now that might be naive and overly hopeful that ideology can ever yield to anything such as brute fact. But anyway, that would help a lot. In the meantime, you know, it's too easy to say we don't have a systemic problem because we don't know enough yet, and the schools are doing that in the same way that they, in different ways, but doing it as well as the NFL and so on, without being forced to really think hard about what it is they're doing. I guarantee you, colleges don't want to give up their football programs. I mean, there will be massive costs to give up their football program.
Let me follow up on this clash of ideology and science, and which I think, Patrick, was a great point that you made in comparing it to debates here in the United States about climate change. Here in the U.S., you do have media outlets that take the side of the industries and political groups who oppose or want to cast doubt on the science of climate change. In your view, you know, the major sports media outlets, so ESPN, the TV network, Sports mm-hmm. Illustrated magazine, they're deeply invested in promoting and celebrating football. So
absolutely, that's their business model.
Exactly,
that's especially ESPN's business model.
So in your view, how are they doing in the coverage of this issue of brain damage in football players?
Well, here's sort of a weird contradiction that. I think at the same time they spend hours and hours and hours promoting and celebrating football, because that is the way that those media outlets are delivering eyeballs to advertisers, and the way they're collecting cable carriage fees from people who like sports and a bunch more people who don't. So it's how they're making millions and billions of dollars out of essentially the rest of our collective interest in football. I think that they have been doing a lot of very critical work on this issue. And I mean, when I mean critical, I mean like harshly critical. Like it's not all like, you know, sunshine and lollipops when it comes to this problem in football. And actually in particular, and I don't say this just because I used to work there and know a lot of people there, ESPN has done a lot of work on this. They were criticized, and I think rightfully so, for dropping out of their partnership with PBS Frontline on the League of Denial documentary at the last second. But League of Denial was written by two ESPN investigative reporters. ESPN's fingerprints were all over that's the book. The ESPN's fingerprints were over the documentary. And if you go and look at ESPN's overall coverage of this issue, they've had a lot of coverage compared to even places like Sports Illustrated and other outlets that you would think might have more because they aren't directly tied to the NFL the way ESPN is. I think that these outlets, because they're still at least partially staffed by sort of, you know, pure of heart journalists, can do a good job, and they care about their integrity and credibility to a point too. But I think that, again, the danger really isn't so much that like somebody at the NFL is going to come to ESPN and say, don't run this story, or you need to fire this investigative reporter. The danger is that the NFL has the best, the slickest, the most disciplined messaging system this side of a political party. I mean, I would compare them to the Republican Party in terms they're incredibly good at figuring out a message, staying on it, and relentlessly delivering it. And all these media outlets who rely on football for their bottom line and just celebrate and cover football and just have football, football, football all the time because that's what we want as consumers— the NFL doesn't have to go and do any sort of dirty bribing or getting people fired. They just put their message out there. All they have to do is put a message out there, and it will get massively disseminated just because that's the way the media covers the NFL. And I think that's sort of the danger. It's that you'll get this, you know, this small stream of critical stories and stories that expose the sort of dark side of the sport and the danger of the sport and the science around that. But that stream will be just flooded by the overwhelming amount of coverage of whatever it is the NFL is saying today.
I've often wondered about this. Okay, when you— there are things that are not known, and then there are things that are known, and when things are known, you wonder why they don't have more impact than they do. But, you know, as Patrick says, they get overwhelmed by the other side. So, you know, and ESPN's a perfect example. I mean, there's something kind of schizophrenic about having really hard-hitting expose on something really dangerous about football and then going nuts on your basic football weekend and covering all the games.
Absolutely. It's an inherent schizophrenia to ESPN. It's been there from the start. Having worked there, I can tell you the people at the company feel it, and there'll probably always be a tension there. But please, go on.
Yeah, and so bad stuff that people should be really wrestling around with, you know, might get overwhelmed. It might not even be seen. If you don't watch I don't know, outside. I'm not an enormous TV watcher, so I don't know this world nearly as intimately as many other people would. But if you don't watch Outside the Line, if you don't watch, you know, Real Sports on HBO when they do one of these things, you know, if you missed Frontline, League of Denial, and so on, you know, maybe despite all this information out there, the information is not getting where it needs to go. And it's not even so much that the NFL massively counteracts it and so on, but it's just not, the information that you need is not getting where it needs to go. I mean, it seems to me that a place like ESPN has an interesting dilemma, much like the NFL's own dilemma. Okay, so the NFL cannot afford to seem indifferent to the, you know, the brain damage, the, you know, the guys that have been dying, you know, the great era players from my era, from the 50s and 60s, you know, who have come up with CTE, you know, Joe Perry, Ollie Mattson, you know, John Mackey, on and on and on and on. You know, the NFL cannot afford for its brand to seem indifferent to them. And so, you know, it will put $30 million towards brain science, brain research. So, you know, the NFL's worst nightmare is that $30 million turns up some really damning evidence about how dangerous the game is. But it's more dangerous for the NFL to seem indifferent. In some ways, ESPN and these other media outlets have a similar problem. Their worst nightmare is that football, particularly NFL football, disappeared. And, you know, what they make their money on is no longer available to them. But they, too, cannot seem to be indifferent. I mean, if they didn't cover the concussion issues, they would seem like, you know, it's fluff. You know, covering the concussion issue gives them their gravitas, you know, their credibility and so on, that is important to their brand. Yet they don't want that message to be so powerful that it, you know, turns people off from, you know, the games of the week and the games of the day and the games of the hour that are running all the time and so on.
Well, we need to get wrapping up. And so I want to close, you guys, to ask you both, Patrick and Mike, what do you see as the future of tackle football?
I really think it is going to, like I said earlier, it's going to become sort of bifurcated, where the adult professional game sort of continues on somewhat the way it is. It's going to have to figure out who's going to pay for the inevitable damage. That's sort of the big argument, the big fight there. Is it going to actually be billionaire owners? Is it going to be the players' union? Or is it going to be a cost that's kicked off onto society, like so much of the other industrial costs of professional football are? And I'm of course, referring to stadium welfare, for instance, in that case. The whole Wall Street model of, you know, socialism for us and capitalism for the rest of you has worked really well. I don't know culturally if that will continue to work well with the specific health costs of football going down the road. Second, at that youth level, and I include college with that, even though it's kind of a weird in-between place, which is a scholastic environment, I think those big moral questions we've talked about are going to be grappled with, and the who's going to pay for it, as Mike mentioned, insurance-wise and sort of liability-wise, and again, medical coverage-wise, may force the issue before the moral questions are really sorted out. Ultimately, I don't think there's any question the game will survive and probably continue to be popular and financially profitable. But I could see a future, and this is not an immediate future, a distant future, where it somewhat goes the way of boxing or horse racing or other sports that were once much bigger than they are now. And football perhaps even takes on sort of geographically and culturally what you might call a NASCAR footprint, where the places that it's incredibly important culture right now, which is the South and Texas and some places in the Midwest, continue to be sort of the stronghold of the sport, but maybe places like New York and the Northeastern Seaboard and perhaps even California and the Pacific Northwest, it really withers. And games like lacrosse and soccer and other sports, basketball, become even more popular than they are now. Last little point on that, if I could buy stock in youth lacrosse right now and hold it for 50 years, I would absolutely do that, because I think a sport like that is in great position to sort of move in onto where football retrenches.
Yeah, I mean, everything Patrick said, I found myself nodding my head in agreement. Let me throw in one point here, though, that actually we haven't made, but I'm assuming that we all have assumed, and that is that losing football would be unfortunate in certain kinds of ways. That football is, in some of its aspects, dimensions, you know, a good thing for us. I mean, when I look at my own experience, I think it's really positive. I mean, I got my physical issues, but they are manageable, you know, with diet and exercise and all that sort of thing so far. So I don't have any personal reasons to sort of, you know, weigh the costs against the benefit and think that this was some unfortunate decision I made or, you know, drifted into way back when and so on. I think it's also a good thing that we have something in our society that actually crosses, you know, gender, class, economic lines and pulls us all together. And, you know, as I said before, the closest thing we have to a mass culture. So losing football, you know, will be a gain in some ways, but it also would be a loss if it happens.
Patrick Ruby's article on parents, children, and football, titled The Choice, was published this past November at the site sportsonearth.com. You can find that piece and Patrick's other articles on the crisis in football at his website, patrickruby.net. Michael Oriard's most recent book is titled The Head in Football, The History of Concussions and the Future of the Sport. It is available as an ebook on Amazon.com. Mike is also the writer and co-producer of a new documentary film titled Gladiators, The Uncertain Future of American Football. You can see excerpts from the film at savingfootball.com. And Mike's own memoir of his days as a player is titled The End of Autumn, available in a reprint edition from the University of Illinois Press. It is widely acclaimed as one of the best, if not the best, memoir of a former football player. This is the year-end episode of New Books in Sports. And as we've done in past years for this episode of the podcast, we need to get some recommendations of good books to read. Whether a new book published in 2013 or a classic that deserves another look. If you are a fan of soccer or cricket or basketball or baseball, our next guests have some suggestions for you based on their reading over the last year.
So, my name is David Mutton. I write about cricket at thesillymidoff.blogspot.com. The favorite book that I've read this year is An Indian Summer of Cricket, Reflections on Australia's Summer Game by Kate McGregor. It's an account of the Test series between Australia and India in 2011 to 2012, which Australia ended up winning 4-0, so it was a clean sweep. But really, the game takes a backward seat to McGregor's reflections and her analysis. She is a lieutenant colonel in the Australian Army and a speechwriter for the chief of the Australian Army. And her, you might see her writing chops because she was the speechwriter behind the video which went viral earlier this year when the chief of the army spoke about why soldiers had to embrace gender equality, and the video went viral. So she's an exceptional writer. And many of her military experiences come out in the book. There were diversions about the American Civil War and how the Indian batsman Rahul Dravid should really pay heed to Ulysses S. Grant. There were parallels between Australian cricketing hegemony of the 1990s and the American military dominance of the post-war years. Those are intellectually very interesting, but I found the most revealing parts were actually her personal reflections. This was her first book on cricket, and although she was a self-confessed cricket tragic, really it's a very nostalgic view of the game. She reflects in very sensory detail on things like listening underneath the covers to the radio commentary as a child, the importance of the pads which her father gave to her as a Christmas present the year before he passed away. So this is really a fan becoming a cricket correspondent, and she details her encounters with her childhood heroes, people like the legend Ian Chappell, and they're almost universally positive. So while you come for the cricket, you stay for the personal memoir and also the discourse on war and other historical matters. It's kind of like a sitting and having a conversation with a particularly erudite raconteur. And the final chapter delves deepest into her personal identity. It details how during the course of writing the book, she realized that she was actually transgender. She started it as Malcolm McGregor and she ended it as Kate McGregor. It's a touching and deeply personal account. And for all of her obvious struggles, it was clearly a very, very difficult time in her life. It's actually surprisingly uplifting to read about how what's often thought as a very conservative game adjusted to that kind of change with really exemplary grace and goodwill. It would be wrong to view the book through that prism of the last chapter, but it is a key component to understanding the author and the very premise behind the book. So that was my favourite book of the year, Kate McGregor and An Indian Summer of Cricket, Reflections on Australia's Summer Game.
Bernard Wimpress, talking here in Adelaide. I'm mainly a cricket writer. I also write on Australian rules football. I play tennis and golf, and I write on cricket and Australian rules football mainly. But I have written a bit on tennis as well. But in real term, I'm just lying here, and I've pulled out a couple of cricket books and also one on soccer that I think may be of interest. They try to call soccer football here in Australia, but that's really a sort of a push by the World Game to dominate our other codes here. Yeah, so one of the books that earlier in the year, of course, won awards both here in Australia and in Britain in the cricket writing world is a Gideon Haigh piece on Warne, which is really an extended essay. I heard Haigh talk about it, and he said he basically sat down and wrote it in a month and it really sort of reads like a seamless piece of writing. The most impressive thing for me about the book is possibly his section, The Art of Warne, where for me, more than perhaps any other book I've ever read, it's a marvelous exploration of technique, and it brings a really a sort of acute appreciation by the author of the of his subject to just, you know, what Warne was about when he was planning his strategies, and then his ability to convert his plans into into action and you know, create the dismissals he wanted. Another book that's just come out here is one really written by a friend of mine, just released this week, called You Only Get One Innings by Barry Nichols. And this book is one of those ones which is a memoir, but where cricket forms, you know, not merely the backdrop, an important backdrop to his life, but it pervades every sort of area of his life. And he actually structures the book with chapters, but instead of chapters, he calls them laws, as in the laws of cricket. And some of them are things like building good partnerships, knowing your limitations, trust your instincts, slow is good. Slow is good is a particularly good opening chapter, because that's where he talks about the importance of appreciating things and, you know, life things, but doing it by learning slowly and gaining more from doing so. And of course, he contrasts the slow game, the test game, with, you know, the one day game and 2020 cricket, which of course is all over in a few hours, and concludes that really isn't cricket, that it should have some other sort of name. And I guess those of us who are traditionalists, you know, share that view as well. Another book that I came on during the year is one of Duncan Hamilton, Duncan is a Yorkshire journalist who's turned out some fantastic books in the last few years. I'm not a soccer reader. Out of my 2,000 sports books, I've probably got about 20 on soccer. But Duncan's done he's a book called Immortal, the approved biography of George Best. And like all Hamilton's work, there's a great deal of excellent research, but not only that, terrific feeling. And his descriptive powers really has the powers of a novelist. And this book on Best is a very, very sad book, of course, because you know everyone knows the short story of a champion player who achieved more than anybody else, but also, you know, his career was blighted with his alcoholism and so on. But what's also sad is simply the price of fame and his, I guess, inability to be able to deal with fame and the attention that it brought. And it's a terrific account of his whole life. And it doesn't pull any punches, but it's a beautiful appreciation.
My name is David Steele, and I am a writer for the Sporting News. I previously have worked in the newspaper industry and the sports media industry with the Baltimore Sun, with Newsday, the San Francisco Chronicle. And I'm the co-author of Silent Gesture, the autobiography of Tommy Smith, written back in 2007. Tommy Smith, the Olympic champion who raised his fist in protest on the victory stand in 1968. And I've had a very enjoyable year in reading books because I've caught up on books that I had promised myself I was going to read for quite a while, and I hadn't. And at the top of that list would be The Natural. And it just dawned on me one day while I was watching the movie. I'd seen the movie, you know, about a million times like most people had, the Robert Redford version of it from back in the 80s. And one thing I'd heard about it from the moment it first came out was that the book was not a lot like the movie version. And I promised myself that I would check out the original book, and I finally did this summer and enjoyed the book tremendously and gave me even more insight into the movie and into the story itself and into the author, Bernard Malamud, who's, again, a name that I'd heard all my life and had never read any of his work before, and it made me into a fan of his and encouraged me to seek out more of his work, which I plan to do in 2014. The other books that I've read that I really enjoyed were bios of some of my favorite athletes over the years. Hank Aaron is at the top of that list, and I read his biography this year. It was written by Howard Bryant, a longtime friend of mine who now writes for ESPN and was formerly with the Washington Post. And I've been a big fan of Hank Aaron's, again, since I was a kid. And once I got my hands on his bio, The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, I ate it up pretty quickly and got a lot more insight into how he grew up. And what I enjoyed the most about it was the detail that the author put into the history of his birthplace, which is Mobile, Alabama. And it's Confederate leanings, it's Confederate history, and how Henry Aaron's father grew up and how his life formed, how his family formed. And I think that Howard really bookended that perfectly with the career and life that Henry Aaron led from there on. So that definitely was one of my favorites. I also read the Jerry West autobiography that came out not that long ago, West by West. And I've been obviously a big NBA fan for all of my life as well, and knew him mostly as a general manager in terms of what I know in person from my career as a sports writer. And I never got to see him in his prime as a basketball player, but sort of knew all the stories about how introverted he was, how shy he was, how reluctant to be very public he was. And that his book, you know, told in his words, put so much of his life and how he's lived it over the several decades into a lot of perspective, going back to, again, his beginning and clearly his growing up years, which included an older brother who was killed in the Korean War. So that was fascinating. And it was a very warts and all sort of biography, or autobiography, so that made it even more fascinating. The other sort of biographical book that I read was about the Knicks of the 1970s. That was my first favorite basketball team. It was written by Harvey Arradin, one of my colleagues during my sports writing years in New York. That was titled When the Garden Was Eden. So I got a chance to read about Willis Reed, who I actually covered when he was coaching in the NBA, Walt Frazier, who I was a colleague of when he was broadcasting the Knicks back in my time back in the 1990s, and a lot about Earl Monroe as well, who I've gotten to know in the years since his retirement because of his ties to Maryland, as is from his years with the Baltimore Bullets. So I would definitely very highly recommend that. And the other one that stuck with me, and probably will stick with me forever, was a book about a fight that a lot of people probably have forgotten about since it was more than 100 years ago. But the title of the book was The Longest Fight, and it was by William Gildea, who I've been reading for years with the Washington Post before he started becoming a book author. The book was about Joe Gans, who's one of the first black boxing champions. This was in the early 1900s, and he had an epic fight that was set up in the deserts of Nevada, in a town that actually doesn't exist anymore, with a fighter named Battling Nelson. And the fight was one of the typical ones of the day. It went on all day and all night and was typically brutal and unforgiving. It's held in the middle of the Nevada sun. There was a lot of sort of shenanigans going on, and clearly the racial politics and mores of the day played into the way the fight was promoted, the way it was set up, the way it was fought, and how Joe Gans was recognized after he won the fight. And it's a very interesting story and ultimately a tragic story about him, which I hope isn't a spoiler for those who may want to read it. But I feel that at the end of this year, my knowledge of the history of this segment of society that I love so much, I mean, I've devoted my entire career to sports writing, was greatly enhanced by reading the books that I have about the people that I was very familiar with, who I learned more about, and the people who I was unfamiliar with, who I got to know even better. And, of course, I would include an author of the best fiction that I read all year, which was The Natural.
Thanks to David Steele, Bernard Wimpress, and David Mutton for their book suggestions. American football has not been alone in being shaken by deep problems and hard questions in 2013. World football has also had a difficult year. In November, a report by Amnesty International verified media reports that workers involved in the construction of stadiums for the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar are suffering terrible conditions that verge on forced labor. Months earlier, in June and July, tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of Brazilians poured into the streets of several cities to protest poor economic conditions and infrastructure and high taxes, while the government spent the equivalent of billions of U.S. dollars on stadiums for the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Summer Olympics. The fact that these protests arose in one of the most soccer-mad countries in the world indicated that there are limits to how much patience people have with government funding of major sporting events. Academic economists, including past guests on this podcast, have long argued that there is little sustained benefit that comes from hosting an Olympics or a World Cup. Do the demonstrations of this year suggest that ordinary people are also becoming aware of this fact, and that international organizations such as FIFA and the IOC will find it hard in the future to sell their spectacles to potential hosts? To get a better understanding of the situation in Brazil and the future of sports mega events, we'll hear from a panel of three experts. Victor Matheson is an economist at the College of the Holy Cross who has written dozens of articles on the economics of sport, in particular major international sporting events. Christopher Gaffney is an academic geographer and journalist who researches and teaches in Rio de Janeiro. And we'll also hear from Tim Vickery, the BBC's South American football correspondent, who is also based in Rio. To start, I'll introduce each of our panelists. So on the line from Rio, we have Chris Gaffney. Chris, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thanks, Bruce. Pleasure to be here, for sure.
And also in Rio, apparently in the neighborhood of Chris, we have Tim Vickery. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, the kind of the less exclusive end of the neighborhood when compared to Dr. Gaffney.
And on the line from the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts is Victor Matheson. Victor, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris and Tim, I'll turn to you. So the FIFA show just came to town, your town, a couple of weeks ago for the draw for the World Cup. Did you get any sense in that the leaders of global soccer have learned anything since the demonstrations of last summer?
They seem to have learned to keep their events far from big urban centers. And so the FIFA World Cup draw was about 90 minutes south of Salvador, and very hard for the ordinary citizen to get there. Huge amounts of security, massive isolation of FIFA dignitaries, quote-unquote dignitaries, and really just isolated the event from the public. They certainly have not made any attempt to diminish their ostentation in one of the most unequal countries in the world, and I think that is a lesson that needs to be learned very quickly.
I was there. I was at the draw. I have to tell you, it was a bizarre place to be at the time when Nelson Mandela died, you know, because the whole world is reflecting on his life and his legacy, and you're just in this little bubble, this little FIFA bubble. To be fair to them, I think that this venue had been chosen before the protest movement, and part of the justification was to draw attention to what is a kind of Brazilian Acapulco, if you like, a Brazilian kind of tourist resort. But it certainly was very convenient for them that, as Dr. Gaffney made clear, that ordinary people couldn't really get there. There wasn't really any chance of a protest movement arriving. And in terms of Brazil, I think there are two aspects to the whole protest thing. There's the relationship between FIFA and the host country, and there's also the incompetence and arrogance of the Brazilian state. These two sometimes can be confused. I don't know if Chris agrees with me, but I think the one that's played out with most importance in Brazil has been the one between the Brazilian state and the population. And that has tended to overshadow in Brazil perhaps the bigger global issue, which is the relationship between FIFA and the host country.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Tim, that assessment that the Brazilians are as much and more to blame for what's gone on in the years leading up to the World Cup than FIFA itself. Because of the number of cities chosen, because of the projects that have been pursued, because of the manner in which that these things have been done, it's really exposed the Brazilian elites, and we do actually identify the ruling class in Brazil as one that is as aloof and arrogant and distant as FIFA is with the rest of the world game. And so what we're seeing is a real differentiation in the Brazilian public between what is FIFA world and the elite VIP world of Brazil and what the rest of us have to live in every day. And when you block off urban areas and secure profits for FIFA and corporations and give elite executive privilege to people who are supposedly representing democratic process, then you have real conflict. Then you have real visible means of saying, hey, look, we're paying for this and other people are benefiting.
And bizarrely, one of the most sensible suggestions has come actually from Jerome Valka, FIFA's General Secretary General, who said that in the future there should be some kind of referendum in host countries to decide if they want to actually stage the World Cup. And something like that would have benefited the Brazilian situation so much, because there was such a glaring lack of debate about the whole thing in Brazil, about how much they were prepared to spend, about what the objectives were. And this suggestion from Valka, I think, is a very good one. Because that lack of debate undermined the whole Brazilian project from day one.
You know, in the United States, we've seen this several times here recently.
with not big events, but with stadiums. And very specifically, we've had politicians avoid public votes on big issues. So, for example, in Minneapolis, where they're building a brand new stadium for the Vikings, there's a law on the books in Minnesota. If you're going to spend more than $5 million on a public stadium of public money, then that's got to go to a referendum, except in the run-up to the stadium being built there. The state legislature very specifically passed an exemption to that law, saying that law does not count if you're talking about football teams in Minnesota. So a law specifically designed to give power to the people, very specifically, the legislature took it away because the writing was on the wall that this would not get approved.
So, Victor, I'll ask you that. Do you think if this came about that you'd have a referenda for mega events, would any countries or cities host mega events, or would it be the case that the cities or countries that could least afford them would be hosting these events?
Well, so, yeah, that's a good question to see how these things work. Where we do have referendas, at least for stadiums and similar things, they don't always pass and they don't always fail. One referendum that actually did occur was the 1976 Winter Olympics that were hosted by Denver. And Denver was awarded the games, and then it went to a referendum, and the voters of Colorado rejected the games after being given them. The only time in history the Olympics have been given back after being awarded.
Tim and Chris, I'll ask, turn back the clock to when Brazil was awarded the World Cup and the Olympics. Did you see in Brazilian society, was there a good amount of opposition or at least dissatisfaction with the awarding of these events to Brazil?
There was complete indifference, really. I mean, it was hard for the world's media to find scenes of people celebrating. It was just the little clacks that the politicians managed to get out to celebrate. Brazil was awarded the World Cup in 2007. And, 7 years ahead in Brazil, that's a long, long time indeed. You know, that's not even long term. That's longer than long. My view is that the battle was essentially already lost then. When the name Brazil came out of the envelope in October 2007, I think the battle for a well-administered, on-budget World Cup with a legacy to society had already been lost by then.
And I'll ask you, Tim, to follow up on that. Why is it the case that this was flawed from the very start?
Brazil knew in March of 2003 that it would be staging this World Cup. And this comes from the rotation principle. Now, the rotation principle was a mechanism that Sepp Blatter and Danny Jordan came up with to ensure a World Cup in South Africa. You remember that Blatter, he couldn't get South Africa past his executive committee for the 2006 World Cup. He lost a controversial vote there and it went to Germany. So it was a political necessity or perceived as a political necessity from Blatter to deliver 2010 in South Africa. And the way they did this was the rotation principle. We pre-decide that 2010 is Africa's turn, and that's the way he did it. So the next turn of the wheel, 2014, where is it going to be? Well, South America hasn't hosted since 78, so it's clearly South America's turn. So that was announced in March 2003. Within 10 days, the South American Confederation had announced that Brazil was their only candidate. I know that Colombia later broke ranks and ran a separate campaign for a short time, but that was never with realistic expectations of victory. And what Colombia were really doing was trying to protect themselves against the rise of their neighbour and rival Venezuela in order to stage the World Youth Cup in 2011, and Colombia were successful in that. So with a 32-team World Cup, really Brazil was the only viable candidate. So Brazil knew in March 2003... Had Brazil had to compete against other countries, Brazil would have been forced to identify host cities and present plans in order just to enter the ring. But because there was no one else in the ring, the discipline of competition was taken away. There was no obligation whatsoever for Brazil to do that. So come October 2007, Brazil hadn't even chosen its host cities. In fact, the political battle to then be those host cities started from that point. The host cities were finally announced at the end of May 2009. That's more than 6 years wasted. And anyone with any awareness of Brazil knows that this has two consequences. This delay means that the price of what you can do goes up and the scope of what you can do goes down. And as I predicted back in 2007, the area where you cut corners is urban mobility. which is exactly the area where Brazilian society had most to gain from staging this World Cup. And we'll end up with stadium. Now, the stadiums will be very impressive, I think. And the attention of the world's media at the moment on the stadiums, I think, is likely to prove counterproductive. Because I think they will be ready, all right, later than the deadlines, but I think that they will be ready, and I think they'll be impressive. I think that they're much more impressive than we thought they would be back in 2007. So the world's media will come, they'll look at the stadiums, that part will run smoothly, and they'll say, well, what were you worried about? What were you protesting about? And that would be to miss the point in as dramatic as a manner as Diana Ross in the World Cup opening ceremony in 1994. You know, because whatever happens on the field, the basic truth of this World Cup 2014 will not be altered, which is that it's cost Brazilian society much, much more than it should have and given much, much less in return.
Yeah, so I think Tim's got a great point there. One of the selling points that Brazil put forward is they said, look, we have learned the lessons of these past events. We know that you don't get the big economic bang from the stadiums. What you get is economic bang from general infrastructure. And so we're going to spend $15 billion, sure, but you know, only a few billion of that is going to be on stadiums. All the rest is going to be on things like mass transit, on airports, on increased security, all these great things. Unfortunately, what we've seen is the costs have been escalating on the stadiums, so the stadiums are eating up much more of your budget. And as your back is kind of against the wall here, you know, if you're one of these host cities, you have to have your stadium ready for this, but you don't have to have the subway ready. So you have a situation where, you know, what was originally cast as, you know, the World Cup gives us a great excuse to do all these things we should have been doing all along, but it's really going to give us that push we need to do all of these great urban renewals and urban revitalizations. But instead, what you get is just the stadiums, none of the revitalization. So you get all of the low return sort of spending and none of the high return spending.
And Chris, I'll ask you, because I know you've written recently about the transportation situation in Rio. So what's your take on how it's looking so far?
It's looking very poorly, and this really goes back to a couple of issues that we've alluded to before. One is that for the World Cup bid, there's never been any bid book presented. And so we had no host cities. We had no idea of what was going to happen from 2007 to 2014. And as Tim rightly and very clearly points out, that we've known about this since 2003. And since then, we've had also the Olympics thrown in on top of this. And what typically happens with Olympic Games is that the Olympic bid book becomes the de facto planning book for the city. And that's the case in Rio de Janeiro. And so while there are transportation interventions happening in Rio de Janeiro, they're following a pattern that is not desirable, and that is bus and car transport. We're extending the metro line a little bit, but we still will have a very limited metro system. Rio de Janeiro, as a port city, doesn't use the water very well at all. The cities are completely clogged. We've had some massive flooding here in recent weeks. And the BRT lines, which are bus rapid transit lines, are being crammed through very dense neighborhood fabric. And it turns out that they were plotted on Google Earth. And so our urban plans come from technical firms that are designing massive urban interventions on their computers at home instead of going out and talking to people. And so, and to kind of tie this back into the original question about what kind of resistances there were, in the Rio 2016 bid book, there's a line that explicitly states there is no organized resistance to the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. If they were to revise that book today, they would certainly have to change that line to note as many as a million people have come on the streets to raise their voices against the realization of these events. But I guess it's also important to note that I don't find that people are against the World Cup because or the Olympics. They're against the way that these things are happening. People are much more against the Olympics because there's not a great tradition of Olympic sport in Brazil, but the World Cup, no one's against the World Cup. I'm not against the World Cup, and I'm one of its biggest critics. They're developing the FIFA World Cup and the People's World Cup in a certain way. And so the cultural aspect was, of course, going to be very rich and a great party, and the games will hopefully not be fixed, and the groups will be transparent and things like this. But what will be left with it, especially in terms of urban mobility in Brazil, and Rio in particular, is nothing. And in fact, it will be much worse because we will have experienced 5 to 6 years of total urban destruction in order to make way for these new transportation lines that won't attend the demands of the city.
Yeah, and I think it's not been my sense that there's any sort of just knee-jerk reaction against mega events in Brazil. And you can see where the protest started. So the protest didn't start with some with groups in some of the big cities. It actually started in Brasilia, which is really where it should start if you're dissatisfied with the way spending has been done, because, you know, this is the worst of probably all the stadiums there. You have a $200 million stadium that turned into maybe a $600 million stadium in a city that doesn't have a first division team and whose second division soccer team draws somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 or 2,000 fans a game. So you've built a $600 million stadium that's going to be handed over to a team that draws 2,000 people a game. This is the worst of the possible white elephants out there. You're not protesting against new subways being built or airports being expanded. You're protesting against the worst of the possible government waste and the worst of the poor planning, you know, leaving yourself with an expensive white elephant.
Let me pick up on that, and I'll ask Tim and Chris. Tim, do you have a favorite white elephant in Brazil as a result of all this infrastructure building?
There are four stadiums that you really wonder about their viability. With Brasilia, certainly Manaus, Cuiabá, maybe Natal as well. I love the way during the protest movement, which really took off in São Paulo, starting on the issue of public transport and then went national. I love the way that the phrase FIFA standard became right at the heart of that protest movement, and people were making their own banners and then taking them out to the streets. And that thing of FIFA stand, you know, the Brazilian state can produce these FIFA standard stadiums. Then why can't it produce FIFA standard health, FIFA standard public transport, FIFA standard education? And I think that FIFA standard, that's something which has really come out of this whole thing. And in a way, and the stadiums, I think, are proving to be much better than we imagined back in 2007. And back in 2007, the original plans were to build stadiums which retained a huge distance between the stands or bleachers, whatever you call them in the States, and the pitch. So essentially then, they were thinking of spending a fortune on stadiums which would be born obsolete. At least that isn't the case now. At least the stadiums are impressive. But the fact that these stadiums are impressive has politically put the authorities in an even worse position. Because if you can do that, why can't you do everything else that the society needs so much more? So you ask about the biggest white elephants, and I'll turn it round and I'll say the biggest normal coloured elephants. You know, the biggest elephant that you want to see is that slogan, FIFA standard. And I really love the way that caught on during the protest movements.
Yeah, yeah. And Chris, your blog is titled Hunting White Elephants. So I take it you have a few that are favorite targets.
Yeah, actually all of them. I think all of the stadiums are white elephants. And because we've had public financing for all of the stadiums, and the only way to make these stadiums viable, quote unquote, is to have people enter with ever more expensive ticket prices or to go to shows, etc. And so instead of considering that publicly financed goods such as education, healthcare, transport, sanitation don't give economic return necessarily, they don't have to because that's what we pay for them. And if you have publicly financed stadiums, why should ticket prices be higher for us to go to them? And so in the Brazilian constitution, access to sport and leisure is a guaranteed right. It's a guaranteed human right. And nine of the stadiums were pre-existing. They were destroyed and then rebuilt with public money. And then now those nine stadiums have also been privatized. And so they've been taken out of the public realm. And so the only logic that directs these new stadiums is that of profit. For private companies. For me, that makes all of the World Cup stadiums white elephants, because the only way that they can be justified is to have private companies make profit at the cost of taxpayers who have already paid for them three times. And so, you know, the stadiums are beautiful. They're just kind of dead, empty North American and European style stadiums that are already painted, you know, so there's no need for the fans to come in with their banners and flags and music, and even the exterior of the stadiums has been sanitized, where you don't have informal vendors selling beer. There's no more churrasco outside of the stadiums. And of course, there's a little bit of romanticism to this as well. But the stadium cultures will radically change over time. And I think that we really need to think about the privatization of all these stadiums as a major negative element of what's happening with the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as totally opposed to the process of sanitization as maybe you are, although I do take all of your misgivings, especially on price. And I'm perhaps scarred by my own experience in England in pre-sanitisation days. And there's a generation which has grown up subsequently, which has a rosy-eyed view of what things were like beforehand. And we have to hold our hands up. You know, English football was killing people on an industrial scale. So perhaps the traumas of that mean that I don't have a knee-jerk opposition to everything which is happening with sanitisation. And I do think there is a legacy of the World Cup in terms of event organisation. It's something that Brazil does badly. Tactics, techniques of how to handle the multitude. And Brazil is at the moment, I'm told, leading the ranking in terms of football-related deaths. And one of the places where this is unfortunately very strong is Goiás. I don't know. I've never been to Goiás. It's very much kind of Hicksville, but I'm reliably informed that an extenuating factor there is that it's an old stadium that doesn't have enough exits, as was the case with the Maracanã until recently. So you've got both groups of supporters going through the same exit. And this is causing rivalries to exacerbate. So I do think that there are gains from the sanitization process, although I take on board all of your misgivings about price.
And what about privatization?
Well, I'm opposed to it. I think it's wrong. Although we do come back to what kind of nationalization, which comes back to what kind of state. The task of nationalizing the state, of making the state responsive to Brazilian society as a whole, is one that still needs to take place. The Brazilian state still hasn't been conquered by its own people, so that concerns me in terms of the previous model of nationalizing. And the wonderful expression here that the nationalized enterprises can all too often become just kind of coat hangers for jobs. People who come in, put their jacket on the seat, and then wander off and do another job and still draw their salary. So the old model, the traditional pre-sanitized model in Brazil, I certainly don't see as a utopia at all.
Of all places in the world, having the ability to upgrade your stadium infrastructure actually in Brazil made sense more than almost anywhere, because Brazil is a place with, of course, a deep soccer culture, but not particularly good facilities to play in. And it's a league that people don't go to. And average attendance at the top level of Brazilian soccer is actually maybe half that of the average attendance in the United States for Major League Soccer. You know, not something that you would consider one of the top leagues in the world. So you have a situation where having a legacy of nice stadiums actually, of all places, might work in Brazil more than than anywhere else. The question is, though, if you're going to be left with Brazil with all of these great new stadiums, you know, who should benefit from that? Should it be, you know, millionaire owners and millionaire players, or should it be people who now have much better and much nicer and much safer places that they can go watch live soccer?
You make a good point, but it's a much more complicated question that has to do with the organization of Brazilian football and the influence of television and the fact that Brazilian football isn't very good in the National League. If you consider that Brazil has something like 2,000 players abroad, and the influence of television networks puts games at Wednesday night at 9:50 kickoff and no public transportation. And then you add that, Brazil has the most, already before the Confederations Cup, Brazil already had the most expensive football tickets in the world relative to minimum wage. And so the stadium upgrades are part of it, but also the way that fans are treated. Here we treat every fan as a potential criminal, no matter what. And so the organization of Brazilian football, getting people to and from the games, the way that fans are even considered the scheduling of the games, the total complete absence of transparency on the part of the CBF, the selling of good players during the European transfer windows that cripples the Brazilian clubs for the rest of the season, all of these have had an effect of decreasing attendances radically over the last 15 or last 10 years. And so the Brazilian league attendance, as you say, is around 12,000 a year, where the MLS has about 19,000, or 12,000 a game, whereas the MLS has about 19,000. Because it's easier for people to stay at home and watch the games. And of course, the insecurity that Tim was talking about, these old stadiums that were not comfortable, that had, in the case of the Maracanã, its principal exit closed in order to install luxury boxes in 2000, a series of ridiculous decisions over time, and the completely unreformed CBF, which is following, the CBF is the Brazilian Federation, which has as its head this 82-year-old zombie that is continuing the same practices from João Havelange, who took over Brazilian football in 1956. And so we've had for 60 years, we've had the same person and or family and or cronies at the head of Brazilian football. And if this doesn't change, then we don't really have much of a hope of putting more butts in seats.
I think it's very interesting that the 82-year-old zombie that you referred to is kind of a failed politician. You know, he was a far-right politician. He got involved in politics in the political party of Plínio Salgado, who was Brazil's wannabe Mussolini-type figure. And you often find this in the administration of football. And Brazil is a federal country. It's divided into 27 states. These states have huge power, or the state federations are more powerful than the big clubs. They're essentially what the players are protesting about at the moment. There's a very interesting protest movement of the players. And these state federations are very often run, controlled, by old political families. It's the old guard. It's people like Marin who have been forced out of democratic politics, and they've found a niche for themselves in football politics. And they are the most dramatic sign, I think, of how little Brazil has actually changed.
Well, let me ask for your predictions as to what's going to happen next summer. Will things go smoothly enough that the rest of the world watching on television won't notice, or will there be demonstrations that will disrupt the World Cup? What do y'all think?
Well, as someone that works closely with social movements, in particular the Comité Popular da Copa and the Olimpíadas in Rio, we are quite sure that there will be protests at every game in Rio. We are quite sure that we'll at least attempt to have protests at all of the 64 games of the World Cup. But on the other side, we've been guaranteed by FIFA that they will put as many troops around the stadium as necessary to carry the games off. And if that's 10 to 15,000 federal troops, as happened during the Confederations Cup final, to confront 10 to 15,000 protesters, then that's the way it's going to happen. And so the conflict is going to happen. There's no question. And not from the peaceful protesters side, not from the social movements that have traditionally held this role in Brazil to contest government policies, but from the police, but also from the black blocs, which have made their presence felt increasingly in the teachers' strikes in Rio and in other parts of the country as well. And so we're looking at 12 Brazilian cities that are going to be contested, and the contestation of the right to circulate in public space during a FIFA event. And surely journalists around the world will be covering this. They'll be looking for this now. And hopefully people will not just turn on their televisions and see the little name of the city flashing by the screen every once in a while and not hear anything or see anything else about the context in which these games are taking place. And so from the side of the social movements, we can absolutely assert that there is mobilization continuing, that there will be national and international articulations of social movements, and that there will be conflict. Part of the way that you get power to concede something is through conflict. And so if Brazil is going to change, there must be conflict. And Brazilians should be desirous of conflict during the World Cup and not look to avoid it. And from my perspective, this is what we're going to see in June and July of 2014.
And if the scenario which Chris has painted is true, which is going to be very, very interesting indeed, then just strictly speaking in terms of the World Cup, there are a couple of consequences for that. And one clear one is that the amount of manpower necessary to deal with the protesters will mean that there won't be as much manpower as necessary to deal with street crime. Now, this is especially true bearing in mind the fact that hotel prices are extortionate. So fans will fan out to areas away from the ring of five-star hotels, and they will be at risk. And it happened to me during the Confederations Cup. I was mugged at gunpoint in the city of Salvador, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was, you know, paying the hotel out of my own pocket, so I'm not in the five-star belt. I'm a couple of miles further down the beach in the three-star belt, and there's not the policing around because everyone is there trying to stop people from invading the stadium and so on. And I think that's a story that the international media will also be looking at because Brazil has such a reputation for street crime.
Victor, how do you think FIFA and these other international institutions will respond to, you know, especially based on what Chris has to say? What do you think the response will be then?
That's a good question. I tend to see both FIFA and the IOC as pretty slow-moving dinosaur organizations that they don't seem to change much in the face of, you know, these escalating costs. And again, I think it all has to do with what sort of competition there is to host their events. You had a very austere games in 1984 in Los Angeles, where you used the same stadiums that had been used 50 years before when Los Angeles previously held the event.
Yeah.
Of course, you'd never see that nowadays, right? You'd never see an opening for an Olympics
and
held in a 60-year-old stadium.
And to jump in, there was no competition for Los Angeles in 1984,
well,
correct?
Of course, that's exactly the reason. They were the only bidder for the games, and therefore the city could dictate the terms to the IOC rather than the other way around. But when you've got these extremely strongly, vigorously contested bids, the Qatar versus the United States versus Australia for 2022, obviously America bitterly disappointed that they don't get the games, despite being able to put forward 100 stadiums that could host a World Cup game essentially overnight. England, very, very disappointed about not getting to host their games in 2018 and instead that going to Russia. As long as you have this strong competition, then, again, the sporting organizations are in the driver's seat rather than the hosts.
So, guys, we're almost out of time, and let me wrap up. One of the questions I'm asking another set of guests for this episode is how we, as fans, reconcile our anger and our outrage over the events that surround sport with our love for the games. And I know that you're all fans of football, and I also know that you're all sharp critics of how football and sport are organized and conducted. So let me finish by asking you, what keeps you from being dispirited to the point of giving up on soccer?
Schizophrenia. It's the only answer. And again, that was so interesting during the Confederations Cup because, you know, many of the protesters were highlighting the salary of Neymar negatively in comparison with the salary of a schoolteacher. So you're wondering there, is there a moment when the crowd are going to turn against the Brazilian national team? Is there a moment when the team are going to be seen as a symbol of everything that's wrong, as a bunch of mercenaries? And in fact, entirely the opposite happened. There was a bond forged between the team and the stands, and without a lot of logic. I hate the fact that you asked me this question because I honestly don't have any rational answer to give. I worry about these things. You know, I have sleepless nights worrying about these things, thinking, what on earth am I doing? Now, watching the violence, the Vasco Atlético Paranaense violence, the savagery there, thinking, to what extent am I responsible for this that is going on? And the only answer I can give you is schizophrenia.
That also guilty of schizophrenia. And I think that, you know, I still play football, and I still love the beauty of the game, or the game itself, and have been, you know, a football fan my entire life, and so to deny that to deny football is a place in my life is to have to reconstitute myself in a way. And what else am I going to talk about anyway? And so, there is, in watching the World Cup draw, even that, knowing it was probably fixed and knowing, the United States was going to play in Manaus and all the things, all the negative things we can think about it, it's, regardless of all that, it still has something in it that connects us to the past, and it connects us to the great moments, and it connects us across cultures and across time. And I try to remember that it is, as Tim says, this schizophrenic reality that you have to suspend this belief at some point in your life in order to at least look at the good and the beautiful in the game. And that still exists despite a lot of very sustained attempts to kill it.
It is a fabulous forger of international friendships, isn't it? So,
yeah.
And it does put us in contact with that inner child. But I'm clutching at straws to try and justify something which I find hard to justify sometimes.
Well, I guess so. My justification is, I'm an economist here, and I generally believe that markets do a pretty good job at lots of things, and I'm fully supportive of allowing anyone to be able to spend their money in any types of entertainment pursuits they want. And if that's buying first-class airline tickets, that's fine. If it's buying luxury boxes at the soccer stadiums, that's fine. If it's buying Rolex watches, that's fine. But, there's no compelling reason that if my love is soccer, that you should have to subsidize my entertainment. So I don't begrudge anyone spending money or earning money making soccer. But I think where the line should be drawn is, I shouldn't be using taxpayer money to let me enjoy my sport, and nor should taxpayers go to be enriching the players or the fans or the owners in the sport.
You can find Victor Matheson's writings at the blog thesportseconomist.com. Chris Gaffney's blog, titled Hunting White Elephants, is found at geostadia.com. And Chris's 2008 book, Temples of the Earthbound Gods, looks at the history and culture of soccer stadiums in Rio and Buenos Aires. Tim Vickery's work can be found on the websites of BBC Sport and ESPN. And of course, you can hear Tim every weekend on the World Football Phone-In on BBC Radio 5 Live. The schizophrenia of sports fans that Tim Vickery described became particularly acute in 2013. The sports pages this year have been filled with stories of forced labor in Qatar, the trafficking of young African men into Europe with the promise of a professional football contract, and the authoritarian actions of the government in Russia, which will host the Winter Olympics in only a few weeks. Add to these controversies the constant drum of scandal over athlete doping, match fixing, and sexual assaults by male players that go unprosecuted. For the fan of conscience, of moral conviction, it can be difficult to block out the stories of abuse, cheating, and corruption, and still appreciate the games in themselves. To close this year-end episode, I asked three people who are writers about sport, as well as fans of sport, to get their view on how the experience of fandom influences our moral identity. We'll hear from Tom Krautenmaker, a regular contributor on religion and public life for the newspaper USA Today, and author of the 2009 book, Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. Following Tom will be Heather Reed, professor of philosophy at Morningside College, and author of The Philosophical Athlete and An Introduction to the Philosophy of Sport. And to finish, we'll hear from Gideon Haigh, award-winning cricket writer for The Australian and The Times of London. Gideon's latest book is titled Uncertain Corridors, Writings on Modern Cricket, just out from Penguin. With each of the three guests, I pose the same question to start. What is the one recent issue in sport that has been most troubling for you from a moral perspective. You'll hear each of them answer in turn.
I have a lot of trouble now with brain damage in pro football. I will point out that I'm now saying brain damage. For years now, I've been worried about concussions, and I've written about that. To me, the problem has escalated. Concussions are a serious thing, and it's received a lot of coverage and debate. But it's adding up to something now that's even more disturbing to me, and that is the brain damage that you get from the cumulative effect of these concussions over the course of a player's career. I have to tell you, Bruce, when I wrote my first book and did all that research for Onward Christian Athletes, that alone made it more difficult for me to enjoy watching pro sports as I had done ever since I was 8 years old. It kind of ruined it for me in the sense that I was no longer really innocent. You know that saying about how you don't want to see sausage made? Well, in doing all that research, I learned and saw a lot of things about pro sports that I found a little bit distasteful. And I wrote about some of that in that book that came out in 2009. If a conservative was reading that, they'd probably think that some of my comments were liberal mumbo jumbo. You know, I talked about racism and exploitation and some crass commercialism. The thing that's happening now, though, with brain damage among retired pro football players, to me, that really rises above political sniping. And that's got to be a serious moral concern for anybody. And it's made it impossible for me to enjoy pro football anymore. You saw the piece I wrote for USA Today a few weeks ago. I'm out on the record as saying that I just can't watch it anymore. For me, the last straw was Junior Seau. What was that, a year and a half ago? Mm-hmm. Committing suicide and all the coverage that got. And I realized that I haven't watched pro football since that happened. I don't want to be moralistic about it and tell other people they can't or shouldn't watch. It's just a personal decision that I've made. And it's not simply because I'm trying to be self-righteous. It's because it's no longer possible for me to set aside that real moral concern and enjoy the game. So I'm not watching pro football anymore.
Tom, one of the questions I've asked a lot of guests on the podcast is why do we watch sports? And so I'll ask you, what do we gain, if anything, in terms of our moral character from being sports fans?
That's an interesting way to put it. When I heard you asking that question, the first thing that popped into my mind was just how much fun it is. I remember being 8 years old and discovering the Minnesota Vikings and Minnesota Twins and this whole fascinating world of big-time sports. And I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I've been an ardent follower of pro sports ever since. I never thought of myself as getting any sort of moral benefit from it. I would say that through my own participation in sports as a youth, I developed certain characteristics and got something out of that. Not so sure it was moral, but I did learn confidence and mental toughness. And yes, I did have fun. So I'm not sure I've ever thought of my following pro sports as being something that had some moral benefit for me. But I certainly do see a moral downside to it now.
So let me follow up with that, Tom. Would you say then you can't see much moral value coming from being sports fans? Would you go the next step and say, is it morally harmful to us to be sports fans?
Yeah, right now as I'm speaking with you, I'm not seeing a huge moral value in being a fan. I do see moral value in pro sports, in the deeds and the words of some exemplary players. It's kind of rare, but you do see that. And I've always thought there was a moral good when famous athletes go visit sick kids in hospitals and speak up for the disempowered and things like that. As a fan, I'm not so sure that I see a big moral upside. I think there are some things we could do that are moral, though, in and around pro sports. I would like to see fans sort of push the National Football League, for example, to take this issue of brain damage more seriously. You might be aware of maybe boycott movements or some organized drives. I haven't heard about any myself, but that could be a case where fans could bring a dimension of morality to the sport that they enjoy following so much. Maybe something could happen in that regard.
It's interesting. I think the thing that really kind of dominates, because it's also in a sport that I participated in and followed, was the Lance Armstrong debacle. And the thing that surprised me about that was not so much the revelation that he had, in fact, at some point doped, but the fact that he had bullied so many other people, other riders, into doing the same thing. And really troubling, or Well, it's troubling, and then I'm also glad it came out because I've been suspicious of it for a long time, is the collusion with the Cycling Federation, the international cycling governing body that it looks like was complicit in many ways in what was going on. And I've been a little disappointed that, in fact, that hasn't been investigated further, because I think on the doping situation, we've been focused way too much on trying to pick out and demonize individual athletes as if they were the only rotten apple in the barrel. And meanwhile, the whole infrastructure that leads the individual athlete to turn to cheating through drugs remains. And that's one reason we're having a hard time getting a hold of the problem.
So it's not a matter of individual laps. It's something that is endemic within the sport. And to pick up with what you were saying, you would say that there's something in the sport that compels individual riders that they have to cheat?
You know, it's an interesting kind of a psychology. I actually think athletes have a pretty good sense of fairness. And we don't really want to win unless it's fair and square. And so what we start to believe, athletes who cheat, what they start to believe is that, well, everybody else must be doing it, or I have to do this just to compete, or I've got to do this for my country or my family or my sponsors. But they come up with some kind of an excuse in their own mind about how what they did really wasn't cheating. But a lot of times these excuses are really sort of self-contradictory. There was a track and field athlete who was caught in the Balco investigation, and I think her name was Kelly White. This is just from memory. But I remember her saying something like, well, everybody else is doing it. But the evidence was that she had been competing at a very high level before she started doping. And then when she started doping, she suddenly started winning. So if it really was a level, no, everybody else was doing it, how come when you started doping, you were able to perform so much better than everyone else right away? So I think that it's just something that they tell themselves in order to rationalize their cheating. And I think in the case of Armstrong and in the case of cycling, it became a little bit of an ethos that you needed to be doing something illegal in order to be competitive. And the ethos is fueled, I think, really unfortunately, by the rhetoric about, oh, how incredibly difficult the Tour de France is and how nobody could possibly do it without drugs. And that's just false. And for me, it's silly. I mean, people survive concentration camps. They can ride the Tour de France without drugs. But if we allow a kind of a paradigm to hold that says that, oh, this is such a difficult sport, the only way that we can really compete is doping, or the only way to be a professional in this sport is to cheat, we really are slowly destroying our sports to begin with.
Heather, what do we gain individually in terms of our moral characters from being sports fans?
Well, I think that there's probably nothing automatic. I mean, that's probably the first thing to say. You have to think about what you're seeing. But at the same time, I think that we gain an appreciation for the excellence of the athletes. And I think we experience it as a kind of beauty, that there's just kind of aesthetic beauty in something like a particular move, like a wide receiver in American football jumping up high and catching a ball on the fly. I mean, there's just these sorts of amazing things, and there's that aesthetic kind of beauty. But there's also a kind of beauty in people really digging in, dealing with setbacks, overcoming a struggle, improving, really doing the kinds of things that we associate with morality. It's a kind of a dramatization of the struggle for virtue and the other kinds of moral struggles we go through in life. They have restrictions on what they're allowed to do. They have a challenge that's very difficult. They have to bring in all their different resources to do that. And by getting involved in that kind of a drama and realizing, as opposed to the kind of drama you would see in a theater, realizing that drama is real out there in front of you. Those virtues are being called on right now in order to achieve the goal that the athlete needs to achieve. I think that that can be inspiring us in order to improve our own kinds of virtues too.
So what is one recent issue in sport that has been most troubling for you from a moral perspective?
Well, I think the one in cricket that you keep coming back to, and the one that you always have the back of your mind is match fixing. I think because it kind of gets to the very nub of our understanding or our assumptions about sport. You know, they're predicated on the belief that people are trying as hard as they can to win. Sometimes, of course, you know, they do that to excess, and you know, they transgress our sort of moral restrictions or our moral inhibitions where sport's concerned. But we kind of understand that in the pursuit of victory, compromises are made. When your belief system that assumption of similarity is undermined, it's a sickening race to the bottom because you begin to question everything that you see on the field. I sometimes wonder that in the present sort of cynical environment that we have any kind of belief system left where some sports are concerned, because so many of them seem to be created spontaneously simply for the reason that there's money available to do it.
Yeah, and this is something that you've written about, is the influence of money in the game. And have you found, you know, for all of the work you've done in looking at the shifts in cricket in recent years and the influence of money, has your moral concern about this, has it affected your love of the game in any way?
It has. It's affected my my faith in the existing institutional structures of cricket to cope with a period of unprecedented change. You know, there's an awful lot of hot money sluicing around cricket at the moment, and yet we're still running it with the governance structures of the 20th century. They haven't really affected the changes that are taking place in the economic environment or indeed in the playing environment. Cricket is a game that tends to march backwards into the future, looking over its shoulder. And unfortunately, it's at the top end, it's extremely slow to adapt, and I think it's being outpaced by the economics of the game, and is struggling to keep time. I think the way in which I sort of recharge my batteries, the way in which I remind myself of how I got involved in writing about it in the first place, is I still go back and play. I play for my club. I've been playing there for 20 years. Somehow all the worries and concerns that I have about the modern game slip away when I'm involved in my own modern game, because actually at grassroots level, cricket hasn't changed very much at all in all the time that I've been playing it. And, of course, it's, you know, kind of galling to us that the idea that you might get paid for playing badly. You know, I've been playing for my whole life badly and no one's ever offered me a bean.
Gideon, what do we gain individually in terms of our moral character from being sports fans, do you think?
From being sports fans? That's an interesting question. I think sport at its best has that ability to sort of transcend difference. All is equal on the playing field. Everyone's trying to win, everyone's trying to play within the rules, everyone's trying to produce a spectacle that's attractive and sort of aesthetically and competitively satisfying. And when you play against an opponent, it's remarkable how much you can find you have in common with them. You know, I went to Papua New Guinea earlier this year to see how they ran cricket up there. Now, Papua New Guinea is a most remarkable country and an incredibly wild and lawless environment. And yet, strangely, when I was dealing with people who were organising the game, people who were playing the game, I felt immediately as though I had an enormous amount in common with them. And it was very, very easy to talk to them because we had this kind of lingua franca between the two of us. I went to a village in near Port Moresby called Hanuabada, which is on the shores of Fairfax Harbour. It's a village of about 20,000 people. It's a fish-based economy. The people there are, by Western standards, dirt poor, and yet I was able to walk along the jetties that project out over the harbour and meet people and talk to people about cricket. And, you know, I felt, as I walked out along these jetties, surrounded by an enormous love of the game, a love of the game that I empathised with and identified with immediately.
My thanks to Gideon Haig, Heather Reed, Tom Krautenmaker, and all of my guests for taking the time to offer their views on the year in sport. If you enjoyed this special episode, please check out our archive of author interviews. This is episode number 75 of New Books in Sports. You can find all of our past episodes on our website and on iTunes, including my previous interviews with Gideon Haig and Michael Oriard. New Books in Sports will be back in January 2014 with a new slate of podcast interviews. Until then, thank you for listening and enjoy the holidays.